This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Saturday, March 23rd, 2019. I'm Caleb Brown. Development economics has itself developed in recent years, according to new president of the Atlas Network, Matt Warner. He says some clear targets for those who work in development now more prominently include strong institutions like property rights and economic freedom. We spoke recently about ill-fated attempts at foreign aid and how to tackle the so-called outsider's dilemma.
How has the mainstream of development economics changed over the last couple of decades? I mean, the Cato Institute handed out its first Milton Friedman Prize for Advancing Liberty to Peter Bauer, who, you know, really at least burned into my mind the idea of the economic development as options, not as big factories churning out stuff.
Right. Well, yeah, starting with his dissent on development, I mean, things really started picking up, you know, steam about 20 years ago where people started questioning the efficacy of what we've been doing since the Marshall Plan. And what's really interesting right now is that you have, you know, a lot of mainstream people who are taking seriously the question of how successful can we be if we're paternalistic about this, if we're technocratic about this? You know, an economy is a complex adaptive system. If you apply kind of a very simple linear solution to it, you're not going to really be able to predict what's going to happen. And that's what we've seen with a lot of traditional approaches to development. So start in 08 and then since then, there's been some different resolutions that have had complete buy-in across the globe about how aid needs to get much more sensitive to local priorities, local vision for change. But of course, that can only go so far as an intellectual exercise, because if governments and aid agencies are the inherently the center of your strategy, regardless of how open you are to, after you establish that fact, what are we going to do from there? I think they're always going to run into a problem. And so at Atlas Network, we talk about the outsider's dilemma, and that's this problem of I want to help, but what if the intervention itself is part of the problem, or at least, not helping?
Right, and you would expect that agencies in D.C. And elsewhere around the globe that are focused on these kinds of problems in other parts of the world, they have to engage in some motivated reasoning, even as they're trying to take seriously the notion that outsiders can make things worse and sometimes do.
I mean, one of the starkest examples, of course, there was a lot of fanfare and celebration around and hopefulness around the big Jeffrey Sachs Millennium Villages project, which over 10 years spent $300 million in different parts of Africa saying, hey, we're going to solve the poverty trap by hitting all the symptoms at once. And, you know, just a quick example, they spent $300,000 in one village in Uganda and convinced them, based on sort of outsider analysis, that instead of growing bananas, they ought to grow corn, essentially. And so they paid everyone a healthy amount of money to make that switch, but they didn't anticipate all the downstream problems that they'd run into. Namely, there wasn't really a market for corn. It was too expensive to get it to, you know, where you could sell it. And it rotted. They didn't have anywhere to save it. And so what starts with presumably good intentions and goodwill, you know, not only did it not help, the villagers ended up very resentful, right? It's like, now we don't even have what we had before, and we have this new big problem. And so what's exciting is that you've got a lot of books coming out on this, Aid on the Edge of Chaos, Navigation by Judgment, Why We Lie About Aid. This is all stuff coming out just in the last year or two that's saying, how do we solve this problem? But at the end of the day, it's very unsatisfying solutions, like we need more field offices on the ground so that our agents are really sort of soaking up the culture. It's still an outsider-led solution.
So I was compelled to read The Elusive Quest for Growth years ago, and that just is a laundry list of attempts to try to bring development to the third world, and they all failed through, it seems one common denominator is that the people in those particular areas were not particularly invested in the solutions that were being brought to them by outsiders. And it seems unclear to me that an outside agency can actually earn that kind of buy-in, at least over the long term.
Yeah, I mean, in some of these projects, the best economic development occurs as a function of the jobs that the aid agency hires for from the locals. Some of the best opportunities that came was working for the aid project, but of course that can't last forever, and that's the big problem. I mean, there was a big report that came out of the UK last year that said, you know, not only is none of this really solving the long term problem. You know, you can of course spend money and help someone. I mean, there's no doubt about that, but it's not economic development. And so for economic development, you have to look at what has worked, and what has worked is economic freedom, strong institutions. And so the big puzzle is, and this is why I think it's an exciting time for the role of think tanks, because the missing piece of the puzzle is, how do you have a local vision for change that seeks institutional improvement, like better property rights, better legal systems, easy to start and close a business? How do you do that by staying faithful to economic freedom and being rooted in the local culture? And of course, a robust, high-functioning local think tank is well positioned to do that in a way that not much else is. So we're seeing a lot of improvements along the path of economic freedom and solving this problem. And so part of our message is, hey, pay attention to the role of local think tanks. It's not going to be from the World Bank and from USAID that the future of economic development is going to come. It's going to come because of individual people carving their own path to prosperity, and they're going to be able to do that because of improvements in economic freedom and institutions.
I tell this story a lot. When I visited Cambodia a few years ago, you walk down the street in either Phnom Penh or Siem Reap, and there are these stalls, essentially. And within those stalls are people selling bottled water. They're selling sunglasses. They're selling snacks, beverages. Some of them are repairing motorbikes. Some of them, if you asked them to watch your kids, they probably would. It is a broad—
They're enterprising.
They're enterprising, but it's a broad range of things that they're doing. So the economist in me says, why not specialize? And without the institutions that you're describing, property rights, getting a fair shake in a court, that sort of thing, and basic freedom to engage in the kinds of exchange that you would like to, the returns to specialization in many parts of the world just aren't very high. And to suggest that these people aren't aware of these theories or of how economic development happens, it's largely irrelevant. Yeah. They see the opportunities before them. They see the extent to which those opportunities might be rewarded, remunerative to them and their families. They're not dumb people.
No.
It's just they have a very clear picture of what the world looks like to them. And you could say that about rural America. You could say that about the inner cities in the United States, and it's just as true around the world.
Yeah, Harvard economist Lant Pritchett puts it well when he says there's mostly not poor people in the world. There's people that live in poor places, and so if you take those people out and you put them somewhere else, where they have institutions, they thrive. So it's not a deficit of talent. It's not a deficit of motivation. It's about the institutions. And one of the biggest challenges is not just to get the institutions right, but this is why local knowledge is so important. It's transitioning from the informal economy to the formal. What does that look like? There is no, one-stop shop roadmap for how to do that, how to take a lot of entrepreneurial energy that's not operating in the formal market, because the formal market is, inhospitable to people in entering it and getting involved in it. It's too bureaucratic, too complicated. How do you transition them in? There's a great paper by William Baumol in 1990 called Entrepreneurship, Productive, Unproductive, and Destructive. And the thing we have to keep in mind is, what he says is entrepreneurs are always with us. There's always an entrepreneurial spirit. I mean, it can be, you know, two ticks up, two ticks down, but it's there. The question is, what are the rules of the game that govern how that entrepreneurial spirit is expended towards, you know, personal growth? And so if you're in Maoist China, you're entrepreneurial about, you know, navigating the political system. If you're in the mid ages, the Middle Ages, you're thinking about how to have title, and it's actually looked down on to be a merchant, right? So, and this is where Deirdre McCluskey comes in, where she talks about how we think about entrepreneurship and how we talk about it and what esteem we give it. What's the rhetoric around it? And I think, you know, if we want a prosperous society, we have to have economic freedom and good institutions, and we have to recognize how important and respectable working hard to better yourself is.
Have aid agencies recognized this, or have they been able to cross that hurdle, which seems like a natural hurdle for any agency that depends on you know, its funding stream being one, solving problems, but two, also employing people?
Yeah. Well, of course, there's a wide variety of strategies employed by aid agencies. And I actually think these days there's a lot of open-mindedness about how do we get innovative and smarter about it. Of course, you know, we've seen a lot of recognition of what I'm talking about in the form of micro-lending. That's been an acknowledgement that the solution is going to come from people navigating their own futures, and they just need a little help. But of course, you know, as Angus Deaton said, you know, where places are hospitable to development, you don't need aid, and where they're inhospitable, aid isn't going to work. And so, you know, whether you're looking at micro lending, or I've talked to a lot of people who are, you know, private equity who are looking in a social entrepreneurship sort of way, trying to help, they're still hostage to what is the environment in which these talented, enterprising people are working. And so that's why I think you need the local think tank who's working on a reform agenda that is faithful to what the empirical evidence says about economic freedom. And that, you know, it's so tempting, I guess, in human nature to say, I want to make a difference, but I want to be kind of the one who understands how it's going to happen, and I'm going to make it happen, versus I'm going to support someone else's vision for change and recognize that, you know, their own path to have the life they want is you know, varied and multicolored and not predictable.
The that second path seems a lot more like the path an investor would take.
Right. Yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, as part of this, you can't really talk about the success we're seeing in the world from think tanks without thinking about best practices in philanthropy. And you know, best practices is also sometimes a double-edged sword, because you don't want to be too prescriptive about the way people should practice philanthropy. One of the things that we do is we create pools of competitive grantees who are trying to demonstrate in very clear ways. We call it calling your shots. We want them to say, here is the reform that we think is not only super important, but achievable. And, you know, in 12 to 18 months, here's what we're going to do to achieve it. And so you can start to identify which are the most viable of all the – I mean, we're about to do a review of a pool of grantees, and there's 150 applicants. You know, we have a really smart team who knows these grantees and reviews these carefully. But you have to be smart like an investor and say, where are we most likely to see success?
So leaving aid agencies aside, focusing more on think tanks, where have been some of the really big successes that Atlas has supported in terms of, you know, countries coming to recognize that, you know, our bottom lines, our budgets will be enhanced if we simply allow for this kind of development, this kind of freedom, and sort of get out of the way?
Yeah. Well, what's exciting is, you know, just in the last 10 years, I'd say, not just the quantity, but the quality of think tank work across the world exploding. I mean, 20 years ago, we had about 150 think tanks in our network in 40 countries. Now it's 480 in 96 countries. And they're all working hard to achieve specific things. I got to thank, you know, Cato Institute and Fraser Institute. One of the things that is so valuable to think tanks around the world is looking at the Economic Freedom of the World Index and looking at how their reform agendas match up with making a measurable difference in that economic freedom. And it in an ambiguous world like nonprofit work, you have to create your own structure and your own measurement. And that's been a great resource. Let me give you a couple of recent examples. For example, on tariffs, we have a partner who came to us and said, we have a 35% tariff in Argentina on laptops and tablets. Because of this, you know, our Chilean neighbors pay a lot less. We're paying, up to three times what you pay in the U.S. This is terrible. And they did an effective job of explaining that, you know, the tariff was benefiting a few at the expense of the many. And they succeeded in eliminating that tariff. And then we've been able to tell the story of some of the downstream effects that their work has had, such as, you know, a philanthropist bought computers and laptops for a very low-income school in one of the worst parts of Argentina, and now those students have access to better technology. A similar example in Sri Lanka. Again, these are very specific things, but they have big impact. Our partner there, Advocata Institute, said we want to eliminate the 30% tax. The 30% tariff on sanitary napkins. And, you know, first you say, oh, that's interesting. Tell me more. You know, and they explained how in Sri Lanka, access to sanitary napkins is very low. They're very cost prohibitive artificially. And as a result of that, girls and women miss out on a lot of school and a lot of work. And many of them just give up and stop going because they get so far behind. And so they succeeded in making the case through research and education and great media presence of saying, guys, this is not a smart policy. And they got it repealed. And so now we're able to tell the story of how that affects real people. Is it libertarian paradise overnight? It's not. But there are real people whose lives are improved because they have more freedom.
Yeah. And it goes to the core of the argument that these are highly specific, as you point out, changes that need to be made in policy. But without locals being the advocates, it's a bigger challenge to understand and then to get buy-in on changing policy.
Yeah. See, an outsider has to know what's important, what's achievable, and what sequence and what design it should take. I mean, I would argue that's not really knowable because it so much depends, like any entrepreneurial enterprise. I mean, leading a think tank and achieving reforms is entrepreneurial. And so much of what an entrepreneur does, they don't necessarily know how to explain it or to say, okay, here's how you do exactly what I did. And so we're seeing that same phenomenon in visionary think tank leaders who benefit from some of the motivating peer network structure that we provide. I mean, in the for-profit world, it's easy to measure how you're doing. You see your balance sheets. And in the nonprofit world, just the size of your budget is not enough. I mean, it doesn't really tell you enough about impact. And so one of the things that we've learned from research is that people are very motivated by how they rate compared to their peers and how they're doing. So it's the idea of defining in our network, what does it mean to be good at this kind of work and to constantly be redefining that upward. And you get some really inspiring, ambitious people, you know, emerging out of that process that are inspiring everyone else. A couple other examples in Costa Rica, our partner there reached a judgment to nullify plans to do price fixing on rice, which would have been a disaster. Similar things under subsidies in Ukraine. We have a grantee there who laid out a reform agenda and achieved a cap on agricultural subsidies, which went to just a handful of producers, and a plan for, and an explicit plan for the eventual removal of those subsidies. There's lots of ways that you can have these successes without necessarily having big ideological battles. You just make very empirical, common sense arguments about justice, fairness, and the sort of net benefit to the country overall. I mean, most countries, unless, you know, it gets too corrupt, then you probably all share the idea that you want the country to succeed and to be more prosperous. There's just a lot of misunderstanding about how to do it.
Matt Warner is the new president of the Atlas Network. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast wherever you get your podcasts and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.